Beloved community. When we hear that term, we often think of folks we know and love and are in community with. We think of folks in our neighborhood, in our family, or in our congregation. Many of us think that our UU congregations has a special kind of beloved community, a wonderful beloved community, and so many of our congregations are. Many find Unitarian Universalist congregations to be communities of like-minded folks where they feel beloved and where they love and care for each other. It's nice that we feel well-loved in our religious communities, but I actually want to hold up a different kind of use for the phrase beloved community today. Beloved community in this context is the idea made popular by Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King way back in the 50s and 60s. We heard some of his words about beloved community a minute ago. The philosopher theologian Josiah Rice actually initially coined the term several years earlier. He was the founder of a movement called the Fellowship of Reconciliation, of which King was a member. Dr. King did not want beloved community to be confused with some impossible utopia where the lion literally lays down with the lamb and all sadness is gone from the world. He was talking about something realistic and achievable. He was talking about what he truly believed could be arrived upon by a critical mass of people being trained in nonviolence and committed to a better world for all. Dr. King imagined a world where all people on the earth would be ready to share wealth and care. He imagined a beloved community as a world where hunger and homelessness would not be tolerated because they were seen as outside the standards of human decency. He looked for a world without racism, discrimination, or bigotry. These would replace the ideals that dealt with the family of humanity. Communication would replace war and sorting out differences, and love and trust would be stronger than fear and hate. Dr. King didn't think there would be a world free of conflict. He knew the conflict was part of human life and the human condition. He did believe the conflict could be handled in a nonviolent manner. Dr. King said the aftermath of violence is the creation of the community. The aftermath of nonviolence is the creation of the beloved community. So when the battle is over, new relationship comes into being between the oppressor and the oppressed. He also said, I don't think of political power as the end, neither do I think of economic power as an end. They are ingredients in the objective we seek in life. I think the end and the objective we truly seek is a brotherly society and the creation of beloved community. So you can see, from Dr. King's words, this beloved community he's talking about is bigger than just our wonderful beloved community here at this home. Much bigger. It's about the community of a wider world. It's not that these smaller beloved communities don't matter, but the goal is to make the whole world a place where respectful communication replaces violence, and all people get their needs met. Well, I heard a wonderful speech at a General Assembly a few years ago by a respected and experienced minister named Fred Muir. He's then published some of this material and updated it in a new book. His piece was called From iChurch to Beloved Community. Here's what he has to say to us about what keeps Unitarian Universalism from being the force for good that it can and should be in this world. What keeps us from being leaders in the creation of King's version of beloved community? First, Reverend Muir holds up the British Unitarians as an example. The Unitarians were well established in Britain long before coming to the US. The British Unitarians have quite a bit in common with their relatives across the pond here. Here's a statement directly from the British Unitarian webpage. Says, Unitarianism is an open-minded and welcoming approach to faith that encourages individual freedom, equality for all, and rational thought. There's no list of things that Unitarians must believe. Instead, we think everyone has a right to reach their own conclusions. We see different opinions and lifestyles as valuable and enriching. We don't discriminate on the grounds of gender, age, race, religion, or sexual orientation. Although Unitarianism has its roots in Christian and Jewish traditions, it is open to insights of all faiths, science, the arts, the natural world, and everyday living. Sounds a lot like us, right? Well, Reverend Fred Muir points out that the British Unitarians are in deep trouble. He says the Unitarian Brits have about 3 generations left before they're going to be all gone. The numbers he cites are sad. Half their churches have closed in the past 80 years. The big congregations, the big ones, are not much bigger than you guys. About 150 members are a big congregation in Britain these days. The average size of an English Unitarian church is 20 members. That despite the fact that the English have some really beautiful and lovely old buildings all over the country. The culprit of decline seems not to be money or love, but the issues of Unitarian culture. This Unitarian culture that seems to be problematic over in England is also prevalent right here in America. Muir worries that unless we make some changes, we could end up in the same downward spiral as the British Unitarians. Muir says we're suffering from, all the way from ministers to members, it's pervasive, a trinity of errors that lead not only to our ineffectiveness, but our inability to effectively share a liberating message in this world. He says these errors erode our vitality and erode our relevance. And they could well be our downfall. Because this is dicey, in describing these errors, I will quote from Muir directly, using his words. First, we are held back and stymied. Really, we are being held captive by a pervasive, persistent, disturbing, and disruptive commitment to individualism that misguides our ability in engaging with changing times. Second, we cling to a Unitarian Universalist exceptionalism that's often insulting to others and undermines our good news. Third, we refuse to acknowledge and treat our allergy to authority and power, though all the symptoms compromise a healthy future. There you go. Individualism, exceptionalism, and issues around authority. That's us, all right. It's true of a lot of us in a lot of congregations all over our big family at Unitarian Universalist Association. And it's not so much that I don't agree with Fred Muir. I really see these traits as getting in our way. They are getting in the way of our thriving as a faith. They're getting in the way of us truly creating that beloved community that King was talking about. In fact, I really do see in my work all the time that these three problems undermine our work. Now, we come by these problems, these traits, so honestly. We come from a long line, and I mean a long line, of heretics. Early in the 15th and 1600s, Unitarians were prosecuted for their heretical and radical beliefs that Jesus was a spiritually gifted human being, but not a part of God. I mean, some people were burned at the stake. It got kind of bad. When you're under that kind of pressure, banding together against the others is necessary for survival. But much later, when our faith was no longer dangerous to espouse, these traits were still fostered. And our wonderful and most famous Unitarian minister of all, Ralph Waldo Emerson, well, he kind of fanned the flames of the Unitarian identity of being a church of independent oddballs. He said things like, I'm quoting here, "No law can be sacred to me but that of my nature." And, "Who would be a man who must be a nonconformist? Nothing at last is sacred but the integrity of your own mind." Oh, bless you, Ralph Waldo Emerson. Many of those early Unitarian transcendentalists, those thinkers, they were the hippies of the 1900s, or the 1800s, they were really into that do-your-own thing kind of stuff. And they were fighting against the Unitarian and the American establishment of the times. But we've got to look at this in context. The fact is that at that time, Unitarians were pretty much all wealthy, well-educated white people of privilege in New England. There's an old joke that the definition of a Unitarian was a Congregationalist with a Harvard education. So if you think about it, we come from radical heretics that evolved into the countercultural upper crust of New England. And then in the 1950s, the fellowship movement began, which focused on calling upon those who wanted to form small, independent, liberal religious groups in university and scientific communities only. Well, you can see where our history has gotten us from here. But this is the situation I see today. As Unitarian Universalists, we are folks, we're great folks with a great faith. Many of us were attracted to Unitarian Universalist congregations because we felt like there we found our people. I know it happened to me. These wonderful groups of, quote, like-minded liberals, quote, who could band together to take shelter from mainstream society dominated by more orthodox religious traditions. We like to hang out with groups of people who listen to NPR and shop at the co-op. It's great that we feel at home here, but there's a dark side to our sense of having found our unique people. We may believe in the inherent worth and dignity of every person, but sometimes we think our worth and dignity is just a little more special than the Baptists or the Adventists. That's part of our problem with exceptionalism. I have heard some really well-intentioned, good UU folks say things like, I enjoy the Unitarian Church because that's where all the well-educated people are. Really? My brother, the Lutheran inorganic chemistry professor, my daughter's Catholic medical school professors, they just must not be counted as well-educated people. Clearly, Barack Obama, the Congregationalist, isn't either. Yes, we have many scholars in our congregations, and so do other faiths. I wonder what it must sound like to other people when they hear us say things like that. Does it really reflect well on us and our apparent respect for people of other faiths? In terms of individualism, it's great that we feel valued for being ourselves, and not just that we fit into molds that other people have made for us. This is one of the wonderful things. I'm so glad the way we raise our children to love themselves, to be who they are. I think it's great that we make decisions based on the democratic process. Members each have one vote, no matter who they are, no matter how much they donate, one vote. Individuality is a good thing, but not so with rampant individualism. That's what happens when the respect for inherent worth of each person goes awry. When individualism becomes highly valued, it's very hard to create and sustain institutions that serve common aspirations and the common good. It's especially true in a congregation where there's any diversity of opinion. I believe that's why consensus decision-making works really well for the Quakers, who I understand are upstairs. But it doesn't work so well with UUs. Quakers have, for many generations, taught a commitment to the success of the whole congregation being more important than the needs and desires of any one member. No single individual would ever be seen as okay for getting in the way of the group decision because of their own personal needs. That's not so with the Unitarians. That's not part of our culture. I believe making sure no single individual is ever disenfranchised in a decision keeps Unitarian Universalist groups from being able to serve any common aspiration or common good. At that point, the beloved individual becomes more important than the beloved community. And then there's our allergy to authority. Muir says resistance to authority often results in the misuse and abuse of power. If folks who distrust authority are asked to lead, their position can sometimes be used to prevent a group from moving forward in a cohesive direction, rather than being used to facilitate moving in a cohesive direction. If a lot of time and energy is spent protecting each other from the leaders within the church, the congregation will be filled with suspicion and conflict. It's not healthy, and it's not pleasant. And it's not at all practicing beloved community. Muir says the misuse of power and authority is a factor in our inability or our unwillingness to welcome and listen to diversity of interests and passions without being distracted and immobilized. In reflecting on how our trinity of errors keeps us from bringing about King's definition of beloved community, I got thinking about something many younger people refer to as microaggressions. This is a term used often in anti-racism and anti-sexism work for behaviors that are not intended to be hurtful but are anyway. They're often subtle manifestations of underlying prejudice that sometimes people are aware of and sometimes people aren't. A study of microaggressions began as an observation that within the Black community, where there was blatant racism, may not have been present, small, subtle insults were present and were still very, very hurtful. Examples of microaggressions might be there's one single Black student in the class, and everyone expects them to be the voice and give the opinion of the typical Black person in class discussions. Other common examples might be sexualized compliments to the pretty young waitress, or assumption that someone, just because their last name is Gonzalez, means they are automatically a recent immigrant from Mexico. No, microaggressions are not the same kind of threat as a KKK burning a cross on your lawn, but microaggressions are hurtful and exhausting nonetheless. Research has found that folks who are exposed to a lot of microaggressions have increased anger, self-doubt, and depression. Well, here's my theory. I believe our trinity of errors, the individualism, exceptionalism, and allergy to authority, they perpetuate a stream of microaggressions that keep us from doing our best in building a beloved community that King talked about. I believe they sometimes keep us from welcoming new members. In fact, I know it does. Let's say you're someone who struggled in school for some reason. Perhaps you had a learning disability, or perhaps you had family issues that made school attendance on a regular basis difficult for you when you were a child. Or maybe you had a fine good relationship with school, but you happen to have a child with a developmental disability. And you come to the UU Church because you hear they're friendly and open-minded and a welcoming place, so you come to check it out. And then you hear someone starting to say how they like our uniquely intellectual nature of our services. Well, that might hurt. That might feel like a microaggression to them. It certainly might sound like they or their child are not the kind of people that you welcome here. I'll tell you straight up, there is nothing, absolutely nothing in our theology of everyone's born good the first time and no one has to go to hell. No part of that you need a PhD to understand. Not one bit. Or if someone came out of the faith, a different faith, where they did a lot of good justice work. Like, let's say someone had spent many years in the Jesuit Volunteer Corps. And they come to a UU church, and they hear how the UUs are so committed to social justice, unlike those other churches. Well, that's not going to feel very good. I also think about issues around individualism and authority. When one of our leaders, either religious or professional, or elected lay leaders, is trying to help build a cohesive, common goal, to help focus resources of the church on meeting that goal, and they hear, well, wait a minute, I never agreed to that, or some similar comment. That is a microaggression. It wears out your elected leaders. It makes good leaders shy away from taking positions where they could do good work, and it makes them afraid to do the job you asked them to do when you elected them. This is particularly important for congregations like yours right now, who have grown from a small family-sized congregation into a bigger pastoral-sized congregation, Once a group gets over about 50 folks, it can't go around making everybody happy all the time. Just so we can just go with the flow, like a fellowship of 20 members who all know each other. You need to have policies. You need to have structures that allow everyone to give respectful input and know what's expected and know what's not expected of them, and allow the leaders to do the job of leading the congregation for the common good. Good elected and professional leaders have an important role to play, and we honor their work, just as we honor the work of other committed folks in this fellowship. Our congregations, where we love each other and feel connected in a special way, are wonderful places. They can be a place where we practice the skills of communication and that nonviolence that King talked to us about. They can be a place of learning, a place of healing. They can be a place of momentum and strength we gain in the small beloved communities that help us build a bigger version of beloved community of all humankind. We can be part of King's version of beloved community as an act of faith, living our Unitarian Universalist values. But we can only do this if we're willing to put away our bad habits of individualism, exceptionalism, and fear of authority. They just fuel our microaggressions rather than enhancing our skills in nonviolence. They will hold us back. They will keep us isolated. They will separate us from the greater human family. Now, I share this with you today because I love our Unitarian Universalist faith, and I love our Unitarian Universalist congregations. Strong and healthy congregations are a blessing to their members, a blessing to the world. I believe we're called on to do some great work and to build true beloved community here in Montana, all over the nation, and all over the world. May it be so, my friends.